Well, it is Father's Day, and I think we have a good opportunity for a word to dads. But I think the things that we're going to share today, you know, we're living in a very broken time, and there's a lot of different situations and circumstances, and every seat is a different story, as we know. And so I think a lot of these principles can also be applied to other parenting situations that are not father-son, father-daughter. But as I said, Father's Day can be both joyous and it can be painful for those who've lost a dad or those who have never had a good example of a dad. Because we live in such a broken world, there have been a lot of painful experiences. But we're reminded over and over again that even though our dads don't always keep their promises, God always does. And he is a picture of a perfect dad who will bring us into eternity with him forever, and every promise that he has made is true. Amen? So the truth is, though, there's never been a greater need in our country for dads than there is today, because it is so broken and families are so fragmented, and I think that we're seeing the result in our culture of children who are growing up in households where dad is not present. In a fine article called Rising to the Challenge of Christian Fatherhood, Rick Johnson calls fathers indispensable. And this is what he writes. I thought that it was salient. He says, "You may not think of yourself as being a particularly influential or even successful person in life. Maybe you don't make a lot of money, you don't lead a large group of people, you don't save lives, you haven't invented amazing gadgets. Maybe life has even beaten you down and you've lost confidence in your abilities. And so consequently, you don't think of yourself as a really big deal. But you can bet that your boy does, or your girl does. He thinks you're a very big deal. He doesn't know or care what the outside world thinks. He only knows that between the walls of your home, you're about the biggest, wisest, most powerful person alive." That's until they become teenagers. That was mine. He knows that you're not perfect, but he doesn't care because you're just good enough to be indispensable in his life. Fathering is the very heart of masculinity, of what it means to be a man, of what it means to make sacrifices. Godly fathers put others' needs before their own. They consciously make sacrifices so that others can benefit and prosper. When fathers neglect this duty or are absent from the home, families are attacked by predators. Families are like flocks of sheep, children like lambs, and they're naive and simple in their understanding of the world. And fathers are like sheepdogs, guarding the flock from marauding wolves. We protect our families from human predators and from the corrupt television programs and movies and music and books and friends and other influences that enter into a child's life. By the way, sheepdogs, he says, are of the same wolf genus. So they're no stranger to the wolves' traits and habits. Fitting, isn't it? We dads often find our hackles being raised up on the back of our necks when we sense a wolf in sheep's clothing parading around our kids. I once told my teenage daughter, "I might not always know why, but I know a wolf when I see one. I can sense them." Of course, my daughter thinks that all the boys I've ever... that all boys are wolves, but I just tell her that's because I used to be one. I prayed many times to my Heavenly Father for wisdom in raising my children. Slowly but surely, I found myself recognizing teaching moments when they occurred. And by God's grace, He spoke through my mouth on many occasions, surprising even me with the wisdom that just popped out. Today, I love being a father. Fatherhood is a privilege given by God, and with that privilege comes the power to impact lives. Exercised responsibly for good, that power can lead to God's blessing on you and on your family. Privilege, power, responsibility, sacrifice. They're all a part of the package. They all belong to what it means to be a father. Be a man. Stand tall. Give your son or daughter an example for your son an example of masculinity that will survive down through the generations. I've heard men often speak in reverent tones about their grandfathers or even great-grandfathers that they've never even met. The power of masculinity, that masculine legacy that they've left behind, has cured and hardened down through the ages like a concrete foundation of manliness. Fathers, you all play a significant role in passing on a spiritual foundation to your children, especially to your sons. Listen to this statistic that he quotes next, because it is astonishing. When only mom takes her son to church while they're growing up, the studies show that approximately 15% of the boys remain churchgoers. But when the father also accompanies the family to church, the number who continue their spiritual journey increases to somewhere around 75%. There's a significant difference, he says, that speaks to the power that men have to spiritually influence their sons. Then in the summer, his testimony, in the summer of 1998, at the age of 12, after this long and sinuous journey of being a father, you know, that he describes, he says, my son asked me to take him down on the field during a Promise Keepers event so he could accept the Lord. I tried making every excuse I could why we shouldn't go. I couldn't help but drag my foot. But finally, we approached one of the volunteers, and the volunteer said to me, why don't you lead your son to the Lord? Gulp. What could I say? After much stumbling, I managed to murmur enough of a prayer to help Frank accept Christ into his heart. And since then, I've been blessed to watch his spiritual journey grow as a Christian. And someday I'll see him, I know, as a mighty man of God. Isn't that beautiful? So, I was thinking about Father's Day this morning, and there are so many ways that fathers impact their family, their children. And one of the things that I really thought we should emphasize today is the role of dad as teacher. The role of dad as teacher. And I think that especially in the age in which we're living, and one in which there are so many messages that are being taught to our children through television, through you name it, in school. I mean, there has never been a greater need for the anchor that a dad is. So here's what I want to say this morning. A dad is always teaching. A dad who is always present in the home is teaching. A dad who's largely absent or completely absent from the life of the family is also teaching something. A dad who piles his family into the car on a frustrating Sunday morning for church on his only day off during the week is teaching a lesson to his children. A dad who stays home instead of coming to church because he needs to tend to that much neglected lawn is also teaching a lesson. God expects certain things from fathers, and we get all of that from the scriptures. God has been very faithful to tell us what he expects of dads. He expects us to love our wives, even like Christ loved the church. If people have a problem with that whole, you know, wives submit to your husbands, respect your husbands. I'll tell you what, love your wife like Christ loved the church. Try that. And he gave himself for the church, died for the church, gave his own life in place. Love your wife that way. And things will kind of sort themselves out with the other stuff. So he expects us to love our wives. He expects us to lead our children without exasperating them, to work discipline into their lives with patience and understanding and love. He expects us to model what it means to be a man who's doing his very best to follow Jesus imperfectly, but sincerely. And no surprise here, he expects us to teach our children. In fact, I think fathers are designed by God to be the primary teacher in their lives of their children. Deuteronomy chapter 6, very famous passage. God is speaking to the nation of Israel. They're just laying it all down. Moses is getting direct revelation from God about what God is expecting of the nation. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. So two things there, if you picked it up. He says, first of all, something about who God is. The Lord your God, the Lord is one. And it's interesting there because we have singular and plural words. So that speaks of the Trinity, you know. God is one in essence and three in personality. But, you know, hear, O Israel, this is what God is like. And then secondly, what God expects of us. That you love the Lord your God with all your heart. And then he goes on to say this. And these words that I command to you today, they shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children. Teach what? What I'm like and what I expect of us. What I expect of people. I expect that you would love me with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your might. Teach them diligently to your children. Well, when do we teach these to our children? Well, talk of them when you sit in your house. Or when you walk in the way. Or when you lie down. Or when you rise. Moses, in another place, Deuteronomy chapter 4, told the Israelites, see, I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God. I'm sorry, Moses is speaking here for God. I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God has commanded me that you should do them. Only take care and keep your soul diligently. In other words, before we can teach anybody else, Dad, we have to keep our own souls pure. He says, keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and make them known to your children and to your grandchildren, your children's children. Why? So that they may teach their children. Don't forget the legacy of faith that we have. Make sure that your children are prepared to communicate that to their children so that 1,000 generations from now, we have a devotion, a blog coming up this week called Love to 1,000 Generations. So that we had something we had talked about in our marriage time. One of the blessings that the Lord promises if we'll walk in righteousness. But we want our family to be blessed to 1,000 generations. And we want the legacy that we have spiritually. And some of you are here today because of the spiritual legacy of your great-great-grandparents who were faithful to the Lord and carried on that tradition of Christian life throughout your family. For some of you, you're the first of a new generation. And you're teaching your children what it means to love and honor God. And you're the beginning of that spiritual legacy in your family. But God says, I want you to teach it to your children and to their children's children so that they might remember from whom their blessings come. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 32, and I love this, it says, when Moses had finished speaking all these words to Israel, he said to them, take to heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And most children today are not, if spiritual things are taught at all, they're taught us something. You know, it would also be nice to go through life and have a spiritual kind of thing too happening. That's not the priority God gives the spiritual life. It's first. Because it's our spirit. What will a man give in exchange for his soul? So, we have this great responsibility. Here's what I'm trying to say this morning. God is continually reminding us of our responsibility to take what he's shown and what he's done for us, and what he's doing for us, and to teach them to our children. And that's true for two reasons. Number one, Jesus said, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Do you see that promise? Everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. So number one, A disciple is not above his teacher. Everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. And number two, if you don't assume that role of teacher, somebody else will. Somebody else will. And when we look at the state of education today, and believe me, I am not criticizing people who work in education. We have fine teachers. We're just living in a time where education reflects the values of the communities in which it finds itself. And what is the state of education today? Steve, who I mentioned, is Pastor Steve Martell, who I mentioned is sick today, pointed out something to me for which I am in his debt. It was an interview with David Barton. Now, I don't know if you know who David Barton is. I got to have lunch with David Barton. I picked him up at the airport one time. He was doing a conference in the air. This is years ago. He's from Texas. I wasn't sure what he looked like, you know, and so I was standing there at Logan Airport ready to pick him up. And then this guy gets off the, comes through the terminal, and he had a cowboy hat that you could have probably fit the entire state of Rhode Island in. And he had a belt buckle that had like cowboy boots on it or something. And I think there was an Elvis impersonator in the terminal, and I think the Elvis impersonator said something like, "Man, that's a mighty big belt buckle." I mean, I knew right away if that wasn't him, he was definitely from Texas. So we had a wonderful, he didn't look like that. His face did, but we had a wonderful dinner. And he is a scholar with respect to American history and Christian history, how God's history has unfolded and the way that that plays itself out in civics and the way that it's playing itself out in education and things like that. And he's written some wonderful books, and I recommend them all. But as we know, history is, as it's been said many times, his story, God's story. It's the record of God working in human affairs, despite all of man's rebellion and all of that. But this is especially true in America, because when we look at our history, there's a real great spiritual legacy that was behind our nation being founded. We had the special goal of being a light for God to the whole world. A city on the hill, Governor Bradford said. Morning, Governor. The governor came and he said that we are a light to the whole world. We are a city on a hill that cannot be hidden. He was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He envisioned the founding fathers, the pilgrims, envisioned this place as a place where God would be honored. And even those that didn't believe in God personal, didn't believe in Jesus, they were deists, or they didn't have a faith, personal faith in Jesus Christ, still believed that the nation had to be run by the principles that are found in the Word of God, the moral principles, like Thomas Jefferson. It would be a place where God would be honored, a place where God promised that those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed, where that promise would be taken seriously. And God had blessed America. And our children need to know that the blessings that we've experienced as a country are God's blessings. It was blessed not because of any happy coincidences, but because God was blessing this nation because its foundation was his word. Now, we've drifted significantly away from that, and we know that. But our history is still important. So this is what Barton was saying that blew my mind in respect to teaching. What is being taught in colleges today? Well, just a couple things to consider. At George Washington State University, to receive a major in history, you are not required to take a single course in American history. As a matter of fact, as of 2018, of the top 26 universities in America, 64 of them do not require a single course in American history to graduate with a degree in history. Barton notes that the quickest way to change the direction of a country is to stop studying its history. So the University of Wisconsin has completely dropped history as a major altogether. Barton says, and I quote, "If I told you that Abraham Lincoln dropped a weapon on Thailand to end World War VII, you'd all laugh at me. But that's only because we've been teaching our history for all of our lives. The reason we would know that's ridiculous is because we've been taught history." How about this? Only 3.2% of U.S. colleges require any course in government or civics for graduation. Only two states in the country require that kids have any knowledge whatsoever of government or civics coming out of high school. According to George Barna, the national pollster, 62% of Americans cannot name the three branches of government. 62%. Again, if the populace doesn't know what the government is about and how it works, it's far easier to change it to some other form of government. And we're seeing these changes right before our eyes. Furthermore, as unbelievable as this is, and I had to look all of these things up that he said because some of them sound so outlandish, but two national organizations of math teachers are claiming that math isn't math, M-A-T-H, is an exercise in racism, and that it perpetuates racism. So that the UCAL, University of California system, has said we're going to stop testing incoming kids for math and English because not only are those kind of racist courses anyway, but the kids don't know the answers, and it makes them feel bad. Now, I read this, and I said, David Barton said this, and I said, this cannot be true. What I'm about to tell you, this cannot be true. So I went to the website of the National Center for Educational Statistics, and exactly what he said is what came up, just under 20%. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 19% of high school graduates are functionally illiterate, and that's after 12 years of school. Now listen, I'm only quoting those statistics. You know, I mean, this is not my area of expertise. Seemed like a completely unbelievable number to me, but obviously factors in all of the situations that we have in our inner schools. And at $13,000 per student average per year and $65,000 per average per student per education, I don't think we should be producing one student that can't read. Barton says that In international testing, America comes in dead last or next to last in science and in reading over the last two decades. We've spent more than any other nation in the world, and we have the worst results to show for it. Education, he says, used to have the SATs. You remember the SATs? Stanford Achievement Tests, which tested basic skills and allowed us to say, hey, Massachusetts is number 6 out of all of the schools in the country. You know, the educational system in the country. But now every state is doing their own testing, so we can't compare like that. And he says, according to current standards, in order for a school to qualify as a superior school, so to say, our school is a superior school, Blackstone Millville Junior Regional Senior High School, I think you needed a master's degree just to say that. You know, BMR was, you know, anyway, in order to say our school is a superior school, the criteria is that 1/3 of the students have to be able to read at grade level. So if I say 1/3 of my 8th graders can read on an 8th grade level, they say, that's a superior school. Again, I'm quoting David Barton here. And what's the payoff? Here are the statistics for the payoff. Only 27% of students who graduate from college with a degree are actually able to find work in their degree field. And the average student in America, as of 2017, leaves with about $37,000 worth of debt for the education that they've received, which by and large was not education, but indoctrination. They've often received a useless education, one that has not prepared them for the real world in any meaningful way, the working world. If you search, this is incredible. If you search Harvard University's course catalog, you will find that the word sex or sexuality comes up 295 times. Now, how does that prepare you for the real world? I want to be a pervert when I graduate. Well, have we got some courses for you? Here are some, these are honest to God, real, now when I say real courses, I'm talking about 3-credit courses, and I want you to hear the sound of somebody taking out their wallet, peeling off $100 bills to pay for these nonsensical classes, okay? These are part of the finest schools in our country, some of the curriculum, some of the electives that are taught. Gaga for Gaga, sex, gender, and identity. Hip-hop feminism. I wouldn't mind paying for that one. Medieval sexuality. What was sex like in the Middle Ages? How about this one? What if Harry Potter were real? That's worth spending money to. That's worth going into debt for, right? How about this? The vampire. The evolution of a sexy monster. You can Google any one of these titles and you'll come up with the quote. The chemistry of beer. One of the campus favorites. How to win a beauty pageant. I think I'd like to solve world peace. What would you like to do if you could do any? I think I'd like to bring world peace and you know, okay. How about this? Oh, psychology in The Simpsons. Queering the Bible. Queering food, separate course. Queering God, separate course. Rednecks, queers, and country music. Campus sex in a digital age. And here's my, I have two favorites. I couldn't decide which was my absolute favorite, but how about this one? Learning from YouTube. Course description, no lie. This course consists of students watching YouTube videos and discussing them. They're also taught to leave comments on the videos themselves. Now, I think I could probably test out of that course. How about this one? Maybe this one's my favorite. This is offered at Montclair State University, and it's simply called How to Watch Television. Now, isn't that worth going into $30,000, $37,000, $40,000 worth of debt for? What I'm saying is that is cultural indoctrination. That is not education into some meaningful preparation for life. And this is, in a lot of ways, this is what education looks like. It's not all this bad. I'm just saying there's a lot of nonsense out there. And what do I mean when I talk about indoctrination versus education? A recent survey found that while 44% of college students who were asked claimed that socialism was preferable to capitalism, the overwhelming majority of the students asked could not define what socialism is. So 44% of the students are answering, oh yes, I think socialism's better, but the overwhelming majority had no definition of what socialism actually is, nor could they give a single example in world history where socialism had increased freedom or raised prosperity. Furthermore, when these same students were asked specific questions about socialism and its principles, it found that only 2% of them actually supported those principles. The reason that the initial 44% said that they support socialism was not that they had actually been educated into knowing what socialism is, but rather because they thought that it was the right thing to say. That's not education. That's indoctrination. They felt that it was more tuned in to say, oh yeah, no, I'm for Bernie. That's what I believe. But they hadn't been taught to look at the historical ramifications of socialism when it's been imposed upon a country. Visit Greece. Visit Spain. They're very different places than they were 20 years ago when all of a sudden the bottom fell out of the economy. Now, that's what I mean when I talk about indoctrination. And there's a statistic that really blew my mind in all of this stuff that Barton shared. The thing that really, really bothered me is this. He shared that 70% of Christian kids that go to college, 70% of Christian kids that go to college leave their faith in college. And some of you young people may know that those are the challenges that you face in the academic community. And in Christian colleges, send your child to a Christian college, that is about half of the people, kids that go there. Now, why? Why? Why are so many young people leaving their faith when they leave the home? You know what? I think it has to do with two reasons. Number one, a disciple is not above his teacher. And everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. If we teach our children explicitly or implicitly the values of the world, don't be surprised when they value those things when they're out of our home. And number two, if we don't assume dads... the teaching role than somebody else will. We need our children to teach them. Amen. Say amen if you believe that. To remind them of our history as a nation, how God blessed us and made us great. We need to teach them our personal history, our family history, how God has blessed us as a family. We need to warn them of the false voices that are waiting in lie to deceive them. We need to talk to them about God when we rise up, when we're walking down the street, in the course of our life. We need to tell them what God is like and what He expects of us. We need to warn them of the dangers of sin and the blessings of righteousness. Because they're not going to learn that at school, and they're not going to learn that on the job. Those are not places typically that we go to find faith. Those are places that we go to lose it or to have our faith challenged. So in light of all of this, I think there's a need for dads to step up as primary teachers of their children to help them distinguish between the things that are important and the cultural stuff of the day. You know, you think about people who grew up in the 60s. If you were a teenager in the 60s, I wasn't. I was a very young child at the time. I was born in 1963, so that would make me virtually an infant. But if you grew up in the 60s, you remember all the cultural upheavals of the 60s, right? Well, you've certainly heard about these cultural, in the sexual revolution and the drug culture and all of this. But you know what? Largely, a lot of that stuff, the news is... Today's news is tomorrow's fish and chip paper. It changes. This never changes. This is God's unchanging word. And our children need to learn that the truth of this word soars above all of the cultural nonsense. Because you know what? Things change. You want to see the country become really conservative real fast? Have another 9/11 type thing. Remember when 9/11 happened? All of a sudden, Oprah's filling these stadiums with people who are trying to find faith, these ecumenical things, people trying to make sense of it all. Lose a war. Lose a lot of people. And all of a sudden, people become very conservative. You know, it's kind of like kids. You know, when kids are young, they're very liberal with money. Have you noticed that? And then they have to pay the first electric bill. And all of a sudden, Dad, would you mind shutting out that light if you're not using it? Right? Yeah, that's a little bit of a different story. Economics makes conservatives of us all. Okay, so on this Father's Day, I thought if it's true, my little postulate that dads need to be the primary teachers, there were a couple of things I was just dreaming about and thinking about of how we might do that. And just some, these is kind of like scattershot. These are like, putting all the pellets into a blunderbuss and just kind of firing it out there. But here are some things that I think in our role of dads as teachers, we can take away and that might be helpful. I've divided it, and this may be legitimate, but it is to me. This is kind of the way I see it. I think being a dad teacher, has two levels. One I'm calling elementary teacher dad. And the other I'm calling graduate level teacher dad. And they're very different, and a lot of problems have arisen in families when a dad who should be teaching at the grad level, meaning mentor level, still treats his children like they're in the elementary level. There is a shift that takes place as maturity comes up. And so that's kind of the way I'm going to kind of separate this here. On the most basic fundamental level, the elementary level, my dear Watson, we're basically providing information and trying to bring understanding to that information. On the mentor level, we're trying to develop a genuine wisdom for life. A genuine wisdom for life. Here are a few things that I would like to just consider, some things that I thought about as I was thinking about this. First of all, let's understand the window. And what I mean by that is, as we talk about this elementary kind of level of dad teacher, understand that there is a window of opportunity, but it may not be open forever. Children at a certain age are naturally curious and absolutely want to know about everything. They're very curious about everything. But at a certain point, that point when they discover Google, they don't need you anymore. They get too cool for school and they may stop asking questions. So Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16 in the King James, the way I learned it, says that we need to be redeeming the time. because the days are evil. They certainly are. The ESV translates that, making the most the best use of the time. The CEV translation has, these are evil times, so make every minute count. But I like the Net Bible translation. I think this really nails it. It says, taking advantage of every opportunity because the days are evil. In other words, there is a window of opportunity that we have to exploit because it may not be open forever. According to September 1937 edition of Reader's Digest, now, I'm quoting this, I'm saying this because I'm telling you where I got it from, because Mark Twain probably never said this. It's not in any of his writings. We can't find it anywhere, but Reader's Digest says he said it. So anyway, Mark Twain supposedly once said, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to be around the old man. But when I became 21, I was astonished at how much he'd learned in 7 years. Now, that sounds like something Mark Twain would have said. But the point is valid. We have a small window where our children look at us as the place to find the answers. They're all ears, and we have to take advantage of that time, and with our grandchildren as well. Every opportunity while we can. Second thing I'd like us to think about, if I'm going to be a responsible teacher, Dad, I've got to be prepared. It would be ridiculous for me to come up here on a Sunday morning. I know a pastor in the city, and I love the guy, but we have a very different philosophy of, you know, pulpiteering. I asked him how, we were sitting down having a coffee in my office one time, and I asked him how he does his sermon preparation, you know. And mine begins on Monday. I call it blank page day. And so I'm curious, how do you do what you do? He told me, this is no lie, he said, I don't study for the sermon. He said, I do my devotionals every day, and he says, God writes the sermon for me when I'm walking to the pulpit. I kind of think that's irresponsible. I really do. And I think for a dad to think that he can go through life as a teacher dad not preparing is irresponsible. There are ways that we need to be ready for the questions that our kids are going to ask, and they ask some doozies. I got a doozy from my my daughter called me one time, and she said, Ryan wants to ask you a question. Not Ryan. I'm looking at Ryan, and I see Jacob with a beard, you know. But Jacob wants to ask you a question. Well, he puts him on the phone, and he had a very difficult question. Now, it was an easy question. It was about, he was watching The Prince of Egypt, and Pepe, did God really kill all of those Egyptian children? How's that for a softball? Well, you know what? Here's where I think we have to exercise some wisdom. Because while we'd like to say, you know what, you just need to cut it straight and tell the truth, a three-year-old doesn't have a capacity to think about God as killing children. Obviously, this is a very complex situation. The children of Israel had made decisions following false gods. Their parents had made decisions to disregard the warnings of God over and over again. And the leadership of the Egyptian people had disregarded God and enslaved his people and brutalized them. And you're not going to tell that to a three-year-old. So what I told him, I'm keeping to myself. See how I did that? Burn. Anyway, so those are like, I don't think that's an uncommon question. I think kids have questions about things like that when they begin to kind of put it together for themselves. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 6, as we read, says that I need to teach the Lord, my children, my grandchildren, something about what the Lord is like, the Lord our God is one, and what he expects of us, that you will love the Lord your God with us. But to answer those questions, listen, this sounds a little elementary, but to answer those questions, I have to know the answer. I have to be prepared to answer it. No one can be expected to know everything. Because children will ask difficult questions. But I do have a responsibility to know those things that every believer should know. And I should do my very best to present myself, the Bible says, as one approved before God, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. I should do my very best to be prepared to share with my children the things that I to answer the questions that they're going to ask. Now, I was thinking about this as well. 1 Peter chapter 3, very famous passage, verse 15, says, "In your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks for the reason, for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect." Now, notice a couple of things here. If I'm expected to be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks for the faith, how much more my own kids? My own grandkids? And secondly, notice how I'm supposed to do that. And I think this is really vital. I'm to do it with gentleness and with respect. You see that? Being a dad teacher requires patience. The word gentleness is a beautiful Greek word. It means without a sense of self-importance. In other words, being able to get down on their level with them. It means humility, courtesy, considerateness, understanding their age, and understanding why they would have those questions. It means not despising their youthfulness, understanding that they're growing up and they're learning, and they have a bunch of things that are all mixed up in their head, and you're their dad to try to help sort it all out in this elementary phase. So we're to teach with gentleness and respect. And there are beautiful websites. I found some just this week. I've known about these for years, but there are some beautiful websites that will that have documents that you can download. In fact, I sent one to Jackie Jagir, my niece, because I thought she'd find it interesting this week, and to Amy. But it's like 20 questions that children frequently ask. And here are the answers, and here are the Bible verses, and here are some approaches that you may have to answering those questions. And if you like, if you want to email me, I'll be happy to send you the link for those. But here are some of the questions that they feel, these family life groups, feel that children ask often. These are not unusual questions for children to ask. Where were there dinosaurs on the ark? Where does God live? Who created God? Why can't we see God? How did Jesus walk on the water? What is heaven like? You know that place where you say your Pepe is, Pepe? What's heaven like? Why do some people die before they're old? How can Jesus live in my heart? These are questions that a good teacher dad should prepare to answer before they're asked. And we're not without resources, dads. I mean, these are free. Download the PDF, and they're beautifully done by Christian ministries that are helping dads and moms prepare for these kinds of questions. And then there's this one. This is also another supposedly popular question. Is there a McDonald's in heaven? And I'll answer that one for you. No, because in heaven, once we get there, we can never die again. A wise teacher will be prepared to answer these questions. You tracking with me here? So there's more to this elementary level than just answering questions. A good teacher dad wants to do something that any good teacher wants to do, and that is capture his child's imagination. I want to tell you the story. I wanted Jacob to come over the house
because I hadn't seen him in a couple of days,
and I was going to kill weeds in the yard. So we went to the baseball game, and I said, hey, could Jacob come over, and he's going to find the weeds for me, and I'll squirt them with the poison, you know, and then after I'll let him play with the poison. I'll squirt the poison, and he can, and then I said, we'll spend some time together, and we'll watch. We like to watch the old 66 Batman shows, and whenever the fight scenes come, and it goes pow, bam, he makes me read, you know, what it's saying, and then he yells it out after, zam, pow! You know, and then the other one is Underdog. We love Underdog. So anyway, we're watching Batman for a while. He got tired of that. This is after we killed all the weeds. It was successful, by the way. They haven't come back. They're afraid. And so then we watched a little bit of Underdog, and then he said, Pepe, can you push me on a swing? So we went in the backyard, and I'm pushing him on a swing. And then we started getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. Is this story getting too deep? So then I said, all right, let's go back in the house. So I says to him, I says, Jacob, I says, his mom wasn't going to be coming for another half hour to pick him up. I said, you want to watch another cartoon? And this is what he says to me. Kind of blew my mind. He says, Pepe, why don't we make our own cartoon? So I don't even know what that means. How do we make our own cartoon? He says, this is no lie. He says, go get a box. We'll cut out a box and make a TV. And then we'll make some monsters and we'll put them inside the TV. So this is no lie. I'm like, I'm completely in awe of this, right? So I had to go get this box. All right? Now, before God, this is all his idea. It's 4 years old. Okay? See this little TV we made? And he says, okay, Pipe, now right on the side of it, this is what I had to write. I have no context for where this is coming from. Beware the penguin. That might be from Batman. Beware the jellyfish monster. Beware the monsters. And beware the penguins again. Then he asked me to get some paper, so I went upstairs and got some scrap paper, and he starts making these characters, these monsters or whatever they are, okay, like this. And then after, we're sitting there, and he's making his own cartoon by putting them like this in the box. Now, you know what? I forgot how to have an imagination like that. And I remember thinking, I'm watching this. We're sitting at our little island in the middle of the Caribbean. No, in the middle of the kitchen. And I'm watching him do this, and I remember thinking, I've got to capture that imagination for Jesus. I've got to capture. You know, it's like natural. They're curious. They're creative. And so these questions that they have deserve an answer. And not only that, but if we can find ways to capture the wonder of that age and bring them into this beautiful time that they're experiencing of letting the imagination go wild and not being constrained by the kind of things that experiences bring, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Look for ways, Dad, to capture their imagination. And then, of course, there are lots of ways to teach children, but in my mind, the very best way to teach children is, and you would all say the same thing, parapoletically. Now, parapetetic teaching is from a Greek word that literally means to walk around. And Jesus taught like this. You know, behold the fig tree. See that temple? Not one stone will be left. Jesus would teach using the things that were around him. So when we were pulling weeds, I was trying to tell Jacob, and he's very young, but I was trying to tell Jacob, you know, if we do bad things, Jacob, it's like weeds. Pipe, why are we killing the weeds? Because weeds don't belong there. It's stuff that comes onto our lawn, and it makes a mess out of things, and it hurts other things, and it's no good. And that's kind of what sin is like in our life. If we do bad things, if we do things that don't please God, those weeds can kind of come in. Now, I have no idea if he was ready for that. But teaching peripatetically is very important because as you're going around, I think that's what Moses was talking about when God speaking through him says, in your rising up and in your lying down, in your walking out and in your coming in, always be trying to show something about God. I got some other stuff here, but let's go to the very bottom of page 19. Of course, the most powerful thing that we can do in teaching our children is to model, the Lord Jesus. The truth is, what I prioritize will speak volumes to my children about what's really important in life. If they see a dad whose lawn is more important than church, I'm just throwing that out there, you know. But if they see that, don't be surprised when church isn't very important to them someday either. If they never see you pray, never see you read your Bible, never see you do a devotional, never talk about God or spiritual things, they're going to learn that those things are not really all that important. We're always teaching. If they watch me run down everyone I know behind my back, if I have no generosity in my spirit when I talk about other people, don't be surprised if they don't take that love your neighbor stuff all that seriously either. Do you see where I'm going with this? The effective way to teach children is to be, the most effective way to teach children is to be the person you want them to become. Show them what it looks like. Treat your son's mother the way you want him to treat his future, your future daughter-in-law. Treat your daughter's mother in the way that you want her to expect to be treated by your future son-in-law. give them the attention that you'd like them to give to your future grandchildren. Do you see where I'm going with this? Love and follow Jesus the way you'd like them to be loving and following him when they're your age. And then finally, the ultimate goal in elementary level dad teacher stuff is leading them to Jesus. This is the big goal. We must look for ways to accurately communicate the gospel of Jesus to them. They're at a very tender age. You're very influential, maybe the most you ever will be. I want nothing more in this world. Nothing is more important to me in this world than to know that my children and grandchildren have a home in heaven waiting for them, and that there will be a homecoming for us someday. We can get them ready for school. We can get them ready for college. We can get them ready to make a lot of money in business. And if they miss heaven, they've missed everything. Jesus put it this way in Mark chapter 8, verse 36 and following. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? And what can a man give in return for his soul? At some point, as we're going, as we're coming, as we're rising up, as we're lying down, I want to make sure that they know about heaven. Now, I know that salvation is God's work, but I also know that God put me in the life of my children and grandchildren because he wants me to help in that work. How will they believe if there is no preacher? Dad, you're the greatest preacher. Granddad, you're the greatest preacher because they know that you love them and care about them. I'm almost done this morning. At some point, our role as elementary teachers ends. Like I said, our children discover Google. But as they grow older and mature into young adults, while our elementary teacher dad role might be over, our role of teacher is not over. In a healthy relationship, that should morph into what I call grad level dad teacher stuff, mentoring. Rather than becoming a teacher in the strict sense of a teacher, you become more of a mentor. And at this stage, our desire should be to give guidance to our sons and daughters through life and inspire them to walk with Jesus, inspire them to seek wisdom. It's here that we seek to inspire a healthy life that has a holistic view. We try to inspire them to have a body, soul, and a spirit that are healthy before the Lord so that they can serve God into their adulthood. It's here that we learn how to help them avoid the trap of too much, a big trap in this country. That old liar that invariably robs us of riches with our walk with God and also of our availability to our family. Getting and maintaining all of that stuff puts ridiculous constraints upon our time, not even to mention the greater financial obligations that the too much trap drags us into. It's here as a mentor that you try to instill these values in your children. It's here that we teach them while all things may be lawful, not all things are profitable, and not all things are wise. It's here that we teach them that tiny equation of spiritual math that more often than not eludes us until the gray hairs come. That less is more. It's here that we teach them what Jesus so clearly taught. Take care to be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. It's here that we teach them that life is far more than the pursuit of money. It's about the pursuit of wisdom. And all wisdom begins with the fear of God. Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Until we get to that point, until we respect God, we'll know nothing of wisdom. And knowledge of the Holy One is insight. But I need to be cautious here as we close. We have to be okay at this level, this mentor dad level, this grad level dad teacher stuff. We have to be okay with them refusing our counsel. We have to be okay with them cutting their own way. We have to respect that they have to stand before God themselves. They will, as we did, have to live in the consequences of their decisions, whether they're wise or whether they're foolish. We can't resent them if they choose a road other than the one that we're pointing toward. We can't take it personally. Because when we do, when we take it personally, we will stop that ability to be a mentor. We're trying to guide, we're trying to lead, but we have to be okay with them choosing a different road. Now, this is not easy, but it's what the mentor stage looks like. It's a lifelong stage of teaching wisdom and pointing our children toward God, the fount of every blessing, the best way that we can. Now, Dad, I know that this is a tall order, but these things are vital. Taking a serious look at our lives as teaching influences upon our children is vital. And it's vital for two reasons. Do you know what they are? First, a disciple is not above his teacher. When he is fully trained, he will be like his teacher. And number two, if we don't assume that role of teacher, somebody else will. Something will fill that vacuum. I pray that it would be us, men of God, serious about our influence upon our. And you know what? Let me just say this. If you feel like, I feel like I've kind of fallen down on the job with that. Or you feel like, you know, my kids are a little bit older and I feel like it's a wonderful opportunity to say, hey, son, hey, sweetheart, let's go have dinner together. Let's talk, begin. Let today be a day where you turn things around and take seriously this role, because I'm going to tell you something. They want to hear it. Even if they would never admit it while the world stands, they want to hear it. What you have to say, your dad, the dad role, the mom role, just vital. So may we all take up the challenge to teach the things of God to our children in every way that we can. And may we all strive to be the person that we want them to become. Amen? Happy Father's Day. Let's bow our heads and pray. If you're here this morning, and if I were to ask you if you know that you have a home in heaven waiting for you,